Good morning. 9 o'clock, time for us to begin. We're in lesson 36 of our study of Daniel. We'll be picking up in a moment in Daniel chapter 11, verse 10. Daniel chapter 11, verse 10. Having gone through almost 36 lessons on Daniel, I know you recognize my disdain for the typical end is near commentary on Daniel, but let me begin today by saying the end is near. I believe that we may finish the class next Sunday, so this may be the second to the last lesson on the book of Daniel. Let me remind everyone that our class audio and handouts are all available on studydaniel.com on the internet, and very soon class notes will be there as well from all of our lessons. And you can go and download those and use those. Those will continue to be there, of course, after the class ends. Excuse me. Also, if you look at your handout today, there are two handouts. This is the one from last week, which I hope you still have, and then this is the new one from this week. There are copies of it back there. If you look at the bottom of today's handout, you will see a tomb. You can kind of see the entrance to the tomb. And if you've been following the news, you will recognize that as the ancient tomb they have just now discovered and are in the process of digging up that they believe may have belonged to Alexander the Great, possibly to Roxana, who we talked about last week, possibly to one of his generals, who we also talked about last week. Whoever it is, they know it's a very important person, and just this past week or so, they found bones. So they found the bones of somebody down there, and it could very well be Alexander the Great. We talked earlier that Alexander the Great died in Babylon, which is pretty far away from where this was found, which is Amphipolis in Greece. But they don't know where Alexander the Great was buried, so he could have died in Babylon and been brought back here for burial. Anyway, very interesting, and that's just happening now as they're digging that up. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this day you've given us, another day to come and worship you and study your word. Father, we're thankful for your word and for all of it, all that it means to us, Father, and we pray that we will continue to proclaim it to the world that desperately needs to hear it, Father. And as we study it, we pray we will understand what your will is for us, and we will see the comfort and the assurance and the hope that is in your word, Father. And most of all, we're thankful for your Son, the Word made flesh, our King and our Savior. We pray these things in his name. Amen. When we last studied chapter 11 last week, we were looking at the king of the north and the king of the south, and we had mentioned that the king of the north and the king of the south will change throughout this chapter. But for the most part, the king of the north will be talking about Syria. Later we'll see Rome, but for the most part it's talking about Syria, and the king of the south will be talking about Egypt. And the current king of the north was Seleucus II Callinicus, the king of Syria, and the current king of the south was Ptolemy III, the king of Egypt. And then we were just about to pick up in verse 10. But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. The his there at the beginning of verse 10 is Seleucus Callinicus. He was the king of the north that we were talking about at the end of class last time. And obviously now we're talking about his sons. Seleucus II, Callinicus, died in 226, and he was succeeded by his son Seleucus III, Soter, who reigned for only 3 years. And he was then succeeded by his brother, Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great. So the two brothers, the sons there, who are two brothers, are Seleucus III and Antiochus the Great. Now, when I say Antiochus, you may be thinking of Antiochus Epiphanes, that we spent a whole lot of time talking about in chapter 8. We're not there yet. We're just at Antiochus the Great. We will get to Antiochus Epiphanes, but he's yet to come. Antiochus the Great is a very interesting study. If you'd like to go further in your study of any of these people, there's a recent book I just purchased on the Kindle, in fact, entitled Antiochus the Great. Very long book that goes through all of his exploits. Very interesting character. We'll see more about him as we study these verses. Antiochus is the one who's mentioned there. It says, and one shall certainly come. That's because his brother only lasted a few years. Antiochus the Great then took over. as the dominant son of Callinicus. And Antiochus then conquered the Egyptians at Sidon and swept down through Palestine. He went as far all the way down to Gaza, which is the fortress that's mentioned there in the end of verse 10. Gaza, which, as we know even today, is getting very close to Egypt. So he swept down that far, Antiochus the Great. Verse 11, "And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it." The king of the south here in verse 11 is Ptolemy the fourth, and the king of the north is still Antiochus the Great. So we have Ptolemy the fourth now as the king of the south, and Antiochus the Great is king of the north. Ptolemy gathered a very large force. He was going to go defeat the forces of Antiochus the Great, who we just saw was heading his way toward Egypt. And that battle was called the Battle of Raphia, which happened in 217. The Ptolemy and Antiochus fighting. And Ptolemy the fourth got back much of the territory that had been lost. He got back all the way up to Phoenicia, and he got back Palestine. But that success did not last very long, as this verse we read just indicated. In fact, Ptolemy the fourth died shortly thereafter. And his son, Ptolemy the fifth, came to power. And what do you think Antiochus the Great then saw? He saw a weakness in Egypt. He decided, now's my chance. And Antiochus the Great then decided he would invade Egypt after Ptolemy the fifth came to power. Ptolemy the fifth is an interesting person. You may not have heard much about him, but you have heard something about you have heard a lot about something he wrote. The Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone, which you can see if you go to the British Museum, is what allowed us, modern people, to understand Egyptian hieroglyphics. Because the Rosetta Stone, which they dug up and buried in a wall in a city called Rosetta, had on it the same thing written in three different languages, two of which we knew and one of which we didn't, Egyptian hieroglyphics. And that let us then figure out what was being said. And in fact, what was written on the Rosetta Stone was a decree given by Ptolemy V, who is the current Ptolemy as we work our way through Daniel 11. Verse 13, "For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches." Well, in the year 202, Antiochus the Great showed everyone why he had the nickname Great. He's the king of the north there in verse 13, and he raised another army, and he invaded Phoenicia, invaded Palestine. He marched again all the way to Gaza, which fell in 201. So you can see going back and forth between the king of the north and the king of the south. Let me remind everyone why we're being told this in Daniel 11. Who's in the middle of all this fighting? God's people. I mean, as they march down through Palestine to Gaza and then get driven back up north and then invade again and come back, they're going right over Palestine. That's why this is of interest to Daniel, and that's why we're being told about it. So let's not lose track of why we're being told all this history. It's because God's people are right in the middle of it. Verse 14, "And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall." The king of the south here is Ptolemy the fifth, same one we were just talking about. The robbers of thy people are the pro-Seleucid Jews who rebelled against the Ptolemies. Remember, at this point, the Ptolemies were back in charge of Palestine. Antiochus was marching back through. Some of the Jews rebelled against the Ptolemies and welcomed in the Seleucids. So they're the robbers of thy people here. And we'll see in a moment why that rebellion was very damaging to the people of God. They rebelled against the Ptolemies. The vision they're establishing there in verse 14, well, that's the vision Daniel's receiving. They're establishing later by doing these things what in fact Daniel is now receiving. They're establishing this vision. Notice the robbers here are called thy people to Daniel in verse 14. And again, that emphasizes these were Jews. These were Jews who were rebelling against the Ptolemies and welcoming in Antiochus. They were led by a guy named Tobias, a Jew named Tobias. I like what one commentary said on this point. He said, "We see from this one incident how intimately the fortunes of the Jews were intertwined with those of these two warring nations, and how soon the Jews could become deeply involved in trouble." And we see that here in this chapter. Both the intertwining with the two warring nations, but how quickly the Jews get swept up in it and get involved in all sorts of troubles. The Egyptians were being led here by General Scopas, and he punished those Jewish rebels very severely until he himself was defeated by Antiochus the Great at the Battle of Paneum in 200 BC. Scopas then retreated to Sidon off the Phoenician coast. So again, you see it going back and forth, back and forth. Just think of a pendulum between the king of the north and the king of the south with Palestine right in the middle. And that's what we're seeing here in Daniel chapter 11. Verse 15. "So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities. And the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people. Neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his will, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed." Well, the king of the north is still Antiochus the Great. And he moved against Sidon, and Scopas there finally surrendered. That's the Egyptian general, and he finally surrendered. And at that time, Palestine, which is referred to here as the glorious land, at that time, Palestine became a permanent part of Antiochus's domain. At that point, he had it and he kept it. When Antiochus entered Jerusalem in 198, he was welcomed there as a deliverer. He was welcomed into Jerusalem as a benefactor. He released Jerusalem from all taxes for 3 years, and afterwards from one-third of taxes. He also sent a large sum of money for service of the temple, and he released the elders, the priests, the scribes, and the singing men from all taxes in the future. So Antiochus was welcomed into Jerusalem. The final phrase there in verse 16 is a little curious with that sort of a welcome. It says, "By his hand shall be consumed." Well, certainly we know that some later Antiochuses would do just that, but we're talking here about Antiochus the Great. A better translation of that phrase is really, he has "with destruction in his hand." I think what that is an idiom for someone who has complete control over something. You know, if you have the power to destroy it or not destroy it, you have complete control over that item. And I think that's what that verse is telling us, that Antiochus comes into Jerusalem. He's welcome there, yes, but he had complete power over that city. And later, that was going to come back to really haunt the Jewish people who were living there. It was his to do with as he pleased. Initially, he treated them with kindness, but that was going to change very, very soon. And those who rebelled against the Ptolemies and wanted Antiochus in would have cause to regret that. Verse 17, "He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him." The beginning of verse 17 there, I think, is better translated, "He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them." What that's telling us is that Antiochus had plans to once again invade Egypt. He set his face to do that. He had a plan to do that. But the text does not tell us he did that. It says he had plans to do that. Instead, what he tried to do was get his way through an agreement. Presumably, if the agreement didn't work, then he might have invaded. But he tried an agreement. In fact, what he tried was a marriage agreement. Antiochus's plan was to marry Ptolemy V, who was at this time 10 years old, to Antiochus's own daughter, Cleopatra the First. You can see the introduction of a very famous name into Egypt, which happened at that time. Now, Cleopatra the First is not Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra. I think we're going to meet her later in this chapter, by the way. But that would be Cleopatra the Seventh. This is Cleopatra the First. Antiochus knew that their son would be legal heir to both thrones, Syria and Egypt. And this would also give him a good excuse to keep meddling and invading and worrying Egypt if his daughter and his son were there. But when the marriage finally took place, a few years later, Cleopatra, it didn't work out as Antiochus had planned. Cleopatra became very sympathetic to Ptolemy V, her husband, and to the Egyptians, and that greatly disappointed Antiochus the Great. And in fact, their son, Ptolemy VI, gave no advantage at all to Antiochus the Great because Cleopatra sided with her husband and not with her father. When Ptolemy V finally died, Cleopatra I became queen of Egypt. And her death then years later really put an end to any possibility of this plan having worked out, and it did not work out. Verse 18, "After this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him." Okay, this really interesting verse, verse 18. Soon after the victory over Scopas at Sidon, Antiochus decided to move against a new front. And that new front was Pergamum and the Aegean coastline, including the island of Rhodes. That's the isle that's mentioned there, the isles. Well, what do you think the Rhodians did when they were being invaded by Antiochus? They picked up the hotline and called Rome. So when you see verse 18 and you see this prince coming in, think Rome. This is the entry of Rome. Meanwhile, Hannibal, who had been exiled by the Romans, joined forces with Antiochus the Great as a military advisor. And this also upset the Romans. The Romans were not happy at all that Antiochus had given asylum to their enemy, Hannibal, and they were not happy at all that Antiochus was invading a territory over which Rome exercised some control. So you now see a new character enter the field here, and that's the mighty Romans, which is going to prove to be a real problem for Antiochus. Now the Roman commander, Lucius Cornelius Scipio, he defeated Antiochus the Great in 190 at Magnesium. That's the same general who defeated Hannibal. And he defeated Antiochus the Great. So Antiochus had made a big error here in upsetting the Romans. Verse 18, I think, is probably better translated, "But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him." That commander, those are the Romans. That commander was the Roman Scipio. Antiochus was humiliated by the Romans. He lost most of his land. He lost most of his army. In fact, his son, Antiochus IV, was taken back to Rome as a hostage. Antiochus IV, that's the one from chapter 8, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. That's the horrible person that we studied about in chapter 8. We're going to learn more about here in this chapter. That's the son of Antiochus the Great. He started off by being taken back as a hostage to Rome. Well, you might think, well, how did he get out of Rome? You know, if he's a hostage in Rome, how did he then come back to cause all the damage he caused? Well, he came back because he was exchanged for his nephew, Demetrius I Soter, who was the son and the heir. And he was exchanged for him. And that is, in fact, what allowed Antiochus to come to power, because he was exchanged for the true heir to the throne. Verse 19, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." Antiochus the Great did not end in greatness. He died the next year while pillaging a temple in Elymais in an attempt to raise money. Why did he need to raise money? To pay the Roman taxes. He was paying taxes and money to Rome because of his loss to them. And he died trying to raise money to do that. The local inhabitants around that temple stormed his forces and a mob killed him defending their temple. So he did not die in greatness. Verse 20, "Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." Antiochus the Great was succeeded by his oldest son, Seleucus IV. The raiser of the taxes that were sent out there, in verse 20, is Heliodorus. Heliodorus is a very interesting character. He was sent to rob the temple at Jerusalem, That's apparently how they raised taxes back then. But a Jewish spy had told him that that temple contained enough treasure to meet all of the Roman demands, to pay off everything that they owed the Romans. He had been told was inside that temple. So he went there to rob it. But it turned out he did not rob the temple, for reasons we'll discuss in a moment. But instead he went back, and eventually he poisoned the king, Seleucus IV. Therefore, that king did not die due to battle or due to mob action as his father had, which is what verse 20 says. He did not die in anger or in battle. He was poisoned by Heliodorus. Now, we're not told much about Heliodorus here. In fact, we're not even told his name, but that's who's being discussed here in verse 20. But if you turn to an apocryphal text, not inspired, but apocryphal text of 2 Maccabees, you'll find a little more about him. And there we find what's written there is that the high priest, Ananias, prayed to God when the temple was about to be robbed by Heliodorus. And 2 Maccabees tells us that God sent a horseman assisted by two young men to drive Heliodorus out of the temple. And in fact, that's why he wasn't able to rob the temple. The 2 Maccabees says that there was a miracle involving these two young men who presumably would have been angels riding the horse. Now, we don't know if that happened, of course. That's not in the Bible. That's in an apocryphal text. But as I think I've mentioned before, I was able to go to Rome earlier this year. And as I was walking through the Vatican, I spotted in the top here, that's a picture I took, Heliodorus being driven out of the temple by the horse and the horsemen. You can see the arrows pointing to Heliodorus over here, the yellow arrow. And you can see this is the picture of the temple. This is a fresco by Raphael showing Heliodorus being driven out of the temple. Now, true, you have to be a little bit of a Daniel geek to recognize that and and take the picture. But I remembered Heliodorus, and I knew we would get to him eventually. So there's the picture, and that's a picture straight out of the Vatican showing Heliodorus, who I believe is the raiser of taxes there in verse 20. Verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Okay, verses 21 through 35. 21 through 35 are going to tell us a little more about Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who we met and studied about in chapter 8. As we recall, he did his best to completely wipe out the Jewish religion and the Jewish culture. He persecuted the Jews and he forced them to take on Greek culture. For instance, death sentences for people who circumcised their children. I mean, whatever he could do to try to stamp out Jewish life and culture and religion, he tried to do that. Now, it may seem that this chapter spends a disproportionate amount of time on him. We're about to go from verses 21 through 35 on this one person. But we recall what we've already learned about him. I mean, he's a focus of the entire book of Daniel, not just chapter 11. We've already seen a lot about him in chapter 8. Just as Domitian, I believe, will later be a focus of the book of Revelation. Antiochus IV Epiphanes is a focus of the book of Daniel. It's at least partially for the sake of this section that we've even been given the preceding 20 verses, so we could get to Antiochus IV Epiphanes and learn these additional things about him. He is the vile person in verse 21, to whom the honor of the kingdom has not been given. Well, we've already talked about that. Demetrius I Soter was the son of Seleucus IV. He was the one who was next in line. He was the one who should have been king. But he was being held hostage in Rome at this time. Why? Because he'd been exchanged for Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So Antiochus IV Epiphanes, his uncle, he was the uncle of the true heir, and he was on the throne. He shouldn't be on the throne. His nephew should have been on the throne. Later, Antiochus was able to... we know Antiochus set aside Demetrius' claims, but Demetrius was later able to get out of Rome and come and try to get his throne back. By that time, Antiochus V was on the throne, though, not Antiochus IV. Epiphanes, we've mentioned, means illustrious. It means evident. It means manifest. And you'll recall some of our earlier handouts showed a coin with Antiochus Epiphanes' face on it. And next to it, it said, Epiphanes Theos. That is, God manifest. He thought he was God on earth. That's what his nickname was. His enemies referred to him instead as Antiochus Epiphanes, which means madman. But he thought of himself as Antiochus Epiphanes, God manifest. Verse 22. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken. Yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably upon the fattest places of the province. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. Yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. Verses 22 through 24 are really bringing us back to the continuing struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. It was Antiochus Epiphanes' standard ploy to first offer friendship to someone and then wait for an opportunity to stab them in the back and launch some sort of a surprise attack. And that's what we see there in verse 23. After the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. That's what he always did. He always tried to reach a peace deal that he would then break. These verses are most likely describing Antiochus's Egyptian incursion. While he was in Egypt, Antiochus espoused the cause of Ptolemy Philometor, who was one of his nephews, against his other nephew, Ptolemy Euergetes, his other nephew, while he was pretending that he had only his nephew's best interest in heart. But of course, he was playing one against the other, trying to get the best deal for himself. In fact, some historians say that Antiochus Epiphanes crowned himself king when he was down in Egypt on one of those expeditions of his. Well, Antiochus VI, that's the one I referred to a moment ago as Antiochus Philometor. Remember, they all have numbers, but we assign the numbers later. So at the time, this time they all had nicknames. And this one's nickname was Philometor, but he's really Ptolemy VI. He launched an invasion against Antiochus. Remember, this is his uncle. So the nephew's launching an invasion against his uncle. It was first successful, but later it led to his capture. And the Egyptians gave up on him. And they put instead his brother, Ptolemy Physcon, on the throne. Antiochus instead wanted Ptolemy VI back on the throne, so he put him back on the throne by force. And at that time, he then saw him as an ally with some sort of a treaty that he'd arranged with him. But of course, we know how he treated treaties. Ptolemy Physcon is known as Ptolemy the Eighth. Ptolemy the Eighth. His nickname, Physcon, means fat punch. You know, I'm not sure what's worse, being deposed by your brother and your uncle from the throne of Egypt or going through history with the nickname Fat Punch, but both of those things happened to Ptolemy the Eighth. Now, eventually, Ptolemy the Sixth made an alliance with his banished brother, Fat Punch, to get rid of Antiochus. And Antiochus then marched against Egypt to settle the matter and dethrone his nephews and just take over Egypt once and for all. But this time, Rome intervened. Enter Rome once again. Rome is always the spoiler to the Seleucids' plans, and this time it's a big-time spoiler. They told him to leave Egypt or face war with Rome. The small people in verse 23 refer to the small invasion force that Antiochus used in his initial invasion of Egypt. He didn't think he needed a big force because, you know, his nephews are on the throne, so he thought he could go down there and get them by deceit. The fattest places of the province refers not only to Egypt, but also to the eastern provinces that he also invaded. Another possible translation is that his nephews finally saw that their uncle was practicing deceit, and that he was becoming strong with but a few people by stealth. And that's really making the same point, that he didn't come in with vast forces because he didn't think he needed vast forces. The prince of the covenant in verse 22 is probably Onias III, the high priest at that time. We studied a little bit about this in chapter 8. Antiochus had him replaced by his brother Joshua, who went by his Greek name Jason, in exchange for a large bribe. Jason was then replaced by Menelaus, who offered an even larger bribe. And then Menelaus had Onias III, the legitimate high priest, killed. So you can see the evil that's beginning here with regard to bribery being the way to become high priest and then having the legitimate high priest killed. I believe that's the prince of the covenant there in verse 22. Verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. Verse 25, I think, is describing the attack by Antiochus against Ptolemy Physcon, the king of the south there in verse 25. In that attempt, I mentioned to put Ptolemy VI back on the throne. I think that's what's being described here. Those Egyptians still loyal to Ptolemy VI plotted against Physcon, Ptolemy, his brother, and the one currently on the throne. Verse 26, in fact, I think tells us that those plotting against Ptolemy Physcon were in his inner circle. I think that's what verse 26 is telling us. They were part of his inner circle. These devices, as verse 25 calls them, can all be traced back to the treacherous schemes of Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the one behind the scenes here, pulling the strings and meddling into Egypt. It's his two nephews who, are, in fact, are fighting for the throne of Egypt. Verse 27, and both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. The two kings, after the defeat of Ptolemy Physcon, were Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI, his nephew. And as this verse suggests, they sat down and tried to make a treaty after the defeat of Physcon, but they were already plotting against each other. They were already plotting against each other. In fact, we're told they did this while sitting at one table, which to the Oriental mind was the worst sort of treachery, to be plotting while you're a host of someone at the same table like this. Verse 27 ends with a reminder that God is in control of these events. They are occurring at the appointed times. And we'll get more of those reminders as we proceed through here. Verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Antiochus returned to his capital city of Antioch in Syria with a great deal of plundered wealth from Egypt. And it's at this point that he sets his mind against the Holy Covenant. That is, he begins to persecute the Jews in real earnest, which is what we saw in chapter 8. The deposed illegitimate high priest Jason had heard a rumor that Antiochus had in fact died in Egypt. He had not, but he'd heard a rumor that he had. So Jason took the city of Jerusalem and locked up the other illegitimate high priest, Menelaus. Antiochus decided to get rid of this problem altogether and to end this Jewish rebellion. So he took the city back, he released Menelaus, he killed 80,000 people, and he robbed and desecrated the temple. That's in 168 BC. We looked a lot about the details of that back in chapter 8. At the verse 29, at the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south. But it shall not be as the former or as the latter, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Again, verse 29 reminds us these are not random events. These are happening at appointed times, we are told, again and again. These verses are describing Antiochus's humiliation by Rome after his fourth invasion of Egypt and his subsequent return to persecute the Jews and to desecrate that temple, which we've already seen discussed. What we're really seeing here is kind of a recap of things that had happened in Antiochus's life. The ships of Chittim there, those are Roman ships. Chittim refers to Cyprus, which was under Roman dominion at this time. And all the areas beyond Cyprus. The Greek translators understood this. They translated this, and the Romans will come against him. They understood that Chittim there means the Romans. The Roman Popilius, general there in Egypt, they capture Antiochus. Popilius drew a circle in the sand around the man. Antiochus Epiphanes is standing inside this circle that is drawn in the sand. And Popilius tells him to make up his mind before he leaves that circle. Either he'll leave Egypt or he will stay and fight war with Rome. And of course, Antiochus makes up his mind. He leaves Egypt. He leaves that circle in utter, utter humiliation at the hand of the Romans. You know, you wonder why he then turned his wrath on the Jews. I think it's a lot to do with how he left Egypt. I think he was upset and he was looking for someone to attack. And I think that has a lot to do with what happened with the Jews. So if that's the case, then Rome was really behind this persecution as well, wasn't it? Because Rome is, in fact, enraged Antiochus, caused him to go back and persecute the Jews. Those who forsake the Holy Covenant in verse 30 are the allies of Menelaus. That's the false high priest. They did not protest as Antiochus came in and pillaged the temple. And we're told Antiochus has intelligence with them. That means he knew who was on his side. He knew who was going to support him and who was not. It was all working behind the scenes. And in fact, that's what we know about Antiochus. Treacherous, behind the scenes. We see that here as well. Verse 31, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, shall take away the daily sacrifice. They shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. This verse gives us more details about the desecration of the temple that occurred in 168 B.C. The abomination that maketh desolate, I think that refers to the statue of Jupiter that was set up in the inner sanctuary. In fact, the temple at that time was renamed the Temple of Zeus Olympius. It may also refer to the desecration that occurred when a pig was sacrificed on the altar, and the altar was sprinkled with pig broth. That also happened at this time. Caligula, the Roman emperor, would later order his own statue also be placed up in the Holy of Holies, but that was never carried out because the Roman governor at the time, and Herod as well, both knew what would happen as a result of that, and they delayed it so long that Caligula finally died. It never happened. But this did happen at this time, hundreds of years earlier, and a statue of Jupiter was placed in the temple. But keep in mind that similarity between what happens later with Caligula and what's happening now with Antiochus, because that similarity is going to become very important as we get closer and closer to verse 36, which we're going to find is a very hotly debated verse. Now in Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus speaks of the abomination of desolation that Daniel the prophet spoke about. And Jesus tells us very clearly in Matthew 24 that that event had not yet occurred, but would occur in the lifetime of his listeners. Matthew 24, verse 34. Thus, Matthew 24, verse 15, where Jesus talks about an abomination of desolation and says, like Daniel the prophet spoke about, that cannot possibly be referring to verse 31 here. It cannot be referring to that. Because this event in verse 31 of Daniel 11 happened hundreds of years before the event in AD 70 that Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24. Well, what then is Jesus referring to? Well, we already saw it in Daniel 9, verse 27. That was referring to Rome. We're going to see the Roman desolation again in chapter 12. It's just not this one in Daniel chapter 11. It's another abomination of desolation, one we've talked about a bit, and one we'll see again in chapter 12. You say to yourself, that all seems a little confusing, that we'd have two different events, both involving a desecration of the temple, and both involving something called an abomination of desolation, and Jesus is pointing us back to one, and, you know, how do we really know? It seems a little confusing. Should we have been given a little warning that something difficult was happening here? Shouldn't we have been warned about that? Well, whether we should have been warned about that's open to debate, but there's no debate at all about that we were warned about that. We were warned about that because look back and read what Jesus said in Matthew 24, verse 15. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. That's Jesus speaking. Jesus pauses at that point and says, okay, when you see the abomination of desolation that Daniel talked about, then Jesus stops and says, those who are reading, understand. Isn't that a warning that we need to be extra careful on this point? That even Jesus is telling us here, on this point, you need to be extra careful in your interpretation? Jesus, of course, knew perfectly well there were two abominations of desolation back there, and he's telling the listeners and the readers. Notice he's talking to people, but he says, whoso readeth. I think Jesus is also assuming that his listeners are going to go back and study this point. readeth. He says, when you read this, be careful. Understand this point. So I think that tells us we also need to be a little extra careful on this point. The abomination here in verse 31 is the one perpetrated by the Greeks. The Greeks. It occurred nearly 200 years before the birth of Christ. It's not the one Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24. That one happened in AD 70. And that one's talked about in Daniel 9:27. It's going to be talked about in Daniel 12, verse 11. It's not the one talked about here in Daniel 11:31. I make a big point about this because a lot of commentaries turn left here when they should turn right. And the reason they do is that they don't pay attention to what Jesus said in Matthew 24:15. When they're reading, they don't take the time to understand what's going on here. Verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Antiochus was a master at winning people over by flattery and empty promises. He convinced many of the influential Jews to adopt his pro-Greek Hellenistic policies. They are the ones that do wickedly against the covenant. They had violated their covenant with God by compromising with the world. Here's what one commentary said about this. In some ways, this defection of the would-be progressives among the Jews themselves was an even more serious threat to the survival of Israel as a nation than the tyrannical measures of Antiochus. For it was the same kind of large-scale betrayal of their covenant obligations toward God that had made inevitable the former destruction of Jerusalem and the Babylonian captivity in the days of Jeremiah. This rebellion against God, this compromise with the world that's happening here, as that commentary is pointing out, that's the most serious threat of all. And that is what was happening at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Those who shall be strong and do exploits, those are the Maccabeans who stood up against Antiochus, who started the revolt against Antiochus. That revolt eventually led to the first independent Jewish state since the Babylonian captivity, which we know lasted for a short time until Rome came in. One commentary said, their uncompromising commitment, talking about the Maccabeans here, to faithful adherence to the Mosaic covenant and law, resulted in the spiritual survival of the nation till the first coming of the Lord Jesus. Well, who is it that's called to have that same uncompromising commitment to God as we await the second appearance of Christ? That's us, God's people today. Here we see God's people awaiting the first appearance of Christ, called to uncompromising loyalty to God. That's what we're to do now as we await the second appearance of Christ. There's a wonderful phrase there in verse 32. The people that do know their God. The people that do know their God. Well, we want to be that people. Why? Because we're told here they do great things for God. They know their God. And we also need to know our God. We do that through study of His Word. Verse 33. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them, and to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. The Maccabean leaders went throughout the countryside and preached a message of repentance, and a return to the law of Moses. And they are the ones with understanding who are instructing there in verse 33. But they suffered great hardship. Many of them lost their lives to Antiochus. He pursued them. He burned their fields. He burned their cities. He killed them. Many of their initial leaders, including Mattathias, died very early during the struggle. Those who were left received a little help, we're told in verse 34, from early supporters. Now, some argue that Mattathias and his family provided much more than just a little help. But compared to the help that God was providing, it was just a little help. And that phrase, I think, confirms to us that this book of Daniel was not written by some second century imposter, as the liberals would suggest, because such a person would never have described this help as just a little help. That description could only have come straight from God. It would not have come from man. When it began to look like they're going to win, many more joined their cause. And many of those were very insincere. They just switched over because they're changing sides, trying to be on the winning side. They're the ones who joined with flatteries, as is mentioned there in verse 34. I think we have some understanding here of the reasoning behind God's activities here. This persecution was to try them and to purge them and to make them white, we're told, even to the time of the end. God wanted to know those who were on his side, and to do that, he brought persecution. He brought persecution. Would we all be here this morning if we faced persecution and possibly death by the authorities to be here this morning? There are places in the world today where that's the case, and they are still assembling. When did the great heresies begin? When the church was being persecuted by Rome, or later when the church was embraced by Rome? We've already talked about that. When it suddenly became fashionable to be a Christian, that's when the great heresies began. This persecution of God's people here was to try them and to purge them until the time of the end. The context of this verse 35 suggests the time of the end is the end of the Jewish struggle with the Seleucids, which came to an end in 142 BC. Judea became politically independent 25 years after the start of that rebellion. The Seleucids lasted a little longer, but their power was permanently broken. It may also refer to the end of the vision, which, as we'll see next week, ends in AD 70. Next week, we'll start with verse 36. I think I may have been a little optimistic earlier when I said we're going to end next week. I think now it'll probably take two more weeks, and then we'll be through with our study of Daniel, because we haven't yet gotten to verse 36. Verse 36 is one of the most hotly debated verses in the book of Daniel, and we'll look at that and the following verses very carefully, and then we'll move into chapter 12. If you have any questions over this difficult chapter 11, again, you can ask me at any time. You can go to the website, studydaniel.com, and send me a quick email by filling out that form. Or next week, of course, we'll pause and ask for any questions on chapter 11 before we move into chapter 12. Thank you very much for your attention.